Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio in Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, if I had to name a theme for our show, I would call it How the Public is Bamboozled by Institutions That Claim to Protect Us When They Are Actually Worsening Public Harms. I invited Jan Hocken onto the show this morning to join me in a conversation about air pollution in Portland, Zenith Energy, and how the system is rigged in favor of polluting industries, while projecting a veneer of public health protection. Before we get to that conversation, we have Fran Michel speaking with Alec Karakatsanis, the author of Copaganda, How Politics and the Media Manipulate Our News. They talk about how media and police narrow our understanding of threats, manufacture fear, and promote punishment as a solution. Before we get rolling, I want to remind you that KBOO is on the air only because of generous support from listeners like you. If you like what you hear on KBOO, please send us some cash, whatever you can. Every little bit helps. You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or by sending us a check at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. KBOO thanks you.
This is what happens when you call the cops.
Say what?
This is what happens when you call the cops.
Come on.
This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot.
Pow.
This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot.
I'm sick of people being victimized by criminal cops. Psychopathic predators terrorizing neighborhood blocks. Equipped with pepper spray, mace, cuffs, tasers, and glocks. They like serial killers acting out subliminal thoughts. Forget what you taught. These cops have got a license to kill. Witness intimidation means that they can use it will. Code of silence means that the pigs will never let out a squeal. And if they go to court, they know the judge will make them a deal. For real, that's why they stopping me, locking me up and stopping me, confiscating my property, talking in my demography, making the poor commodities, profiting off of poverty, enforcing policies, supporting prison economies. Yeah, no one makes money when the violence stops. Hating brutality's the way to make a criminal crop. Blood in the gutters, how the rich butter they bread at the top. And that's why this is what happens when you call the cops.
Come on. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot.
911, what's your emergency?
I'm mixed up in the system and these pigs is trying to murder me. They mace me, they tase me, they trained them to hate me, degrade and detain me and change just like slavery. Hands up, face down, left.
That was Call the Cops by hip-hop artist Rob Hussle. Police and the entire so-called justice system, according to lawyer, author, and activist Alec Karakatsanis, serve to perpetuate harm to the public and actually increase violence within our communities. Here's Fran Michel to explore further a very different narrative than the one we are constantly fed by mainstream media about how police, prosecution, and prison makes us less safe.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Alec Karakatsanis. Alec is a civil rights lawyer and founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps, a nonprofit organization dedicated to challenging systemic injustice in the U.S. legal system. He's also written widely on this topic, including the 2019 book, Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System, and a 2024 article in the Yale Journal of Law and Liberation on how the body camera movement has further entrenched the police state, sadly not available in time to prevent Portland from investing in body cameras. Since 2022, he's been writing Alec's Copaganda newsletter about how police and the media distract us from what matters. And he's just out with a new book that draws on some of that material, Copaganda, How Police and Media Manipulate Our News. He'll be appearing at Powell's Books on Burnside on Sunday the 18th at 7 p.m. Thank you for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, Alec Karakatsanis.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think most listeners to the Old Mole Variety Hour probably have some sense of what Kopaganda is, but could you get us started by giving us a brief description of the concept as well as how you approach it in your new book?
For me, Kopaganda is really about how does the policing and punishment bureaucracy, so this constellation, not just of all the people we think of, you know, police, prosecutors, prison guards, probation, parole, this whole apparatus of bureaucrats, but also the series of multi-billion dollar corporate industries that are parasitic on every single stage of that industry. You know, how does this entire punishment bureaucracy get us to support constantly? And particularly, how does it get well-meaning people or people who have progressive and liberal values, people who want a more equal and egalitarian and nonviolent society? How does it get all of those people to support continuously, year after year, more and more investment in the bureaucracies of state violence and oppression? So specifically for me, Kopaganda has really three main functions. The first function is it narrows our conception of threat and safety. It has us focused on the threats or supposed threats posed by poor people, by immigrants, by people of color, particularly Black people, by unhoused people in particular, by people with disabilities, and by strangers, as opposed to the things that actually cause the vast bulk of interpersonal harm in our society. So most violent incidents, most sexual misconduct occur between people who know each other, for example. It's not really focused on in the news, right? Or take wage theft. It's a $50 billion a year problem. It's about five times all property crime combined. Or tax evasion. It's about $1 trillion a year. So it's 60 times all the property crime police focus on combined. Or air pollution. It kills 100,000 people a year. Five times all homicide. Water pollution, et cetera, go on and on. These are the kinds of things that are not focused on in high volume in the daily news. The second thing the Kopaganda does is it, having narrowed our conception of threat, it makes us afraid that these narrow range of threats are always increasing, right? So if you look at the Gallup polling every year for the last 25 years, people say crime is way up in our society, even though almost every single one of those years, crime is down and crime is at historic lows right now. And if you look at those same polls, people are much more accurate about their own neighborhood. So they're much more likely to say, well, crime in my neighborhood isn't increasing at all, but crime everywhere else is. And that's because when your experience is direct and personal, you're much less likely to be wrong. But when your experience is mediated through the mass media, you're much more likely to be subject to this sort of misinformation. Now, obviously, there's also all kinds of ways in which our estimations of crime in our own neighborhood is often distorted because of things like Nextdoor and Citizen and all the sort of various fear-mongering on our own neighborhood listservs. But the third major function of Kopaganda is really connected to this, which is that people, when they're in a state of constant fear, they're much more likely to accept authoritarian interventions. And so the third main function of Kopaganda is it's always selling us on the idea that the main solution to our fears is more police, more prosecution, more prison, more investment in the punishment bureaucracy. And that's like a modern day flat earther movement. This is sort of like climate science denial. I mean, we know from all of the evidence that the things that actually determine levels of harm and violence in a society are things like inequality, poverty, access to healthcare, early childhood education, exposure to certain toxic chemicals like lead, toxic masculinity, levels of alienation and isolation versus levels of community engagement and participation. These are the things that actually determine whether we're safe in a society or not, and not investments in policing, prosecution, and prisons. But Kopaganda's got us thinking it all backward.
Portland, Oregon is right now in the middle of our yearly budget process and facing the typical shortfall in revenue. And our mayor wants to increase funding for the police, arguing that doing so is in the interest of public safety, even though he acknowledges that homicides are decreasing. In fact, all of the kinds of crime that police measure in Portland are going down. But then this becomes itself an argument for more police. I mean, the mayor suggests that, well, homicides are going down, therefore that shows the police are doing a good job and we need to give them more money. How is it that if crime goes up, that's an argument for more police to stop the crime, but when crime goes down, it's an argument for funding police to keep doing what they're doing? Can you comment on the relation between data and arguments and the ways that that gets presented to people?
In the book, I have a number of chapters about data and about how data is reported and manipulated. And so, you know, I'll preface my comments by saying there's a huge industry and a very important misinformation role played by elite academics in the weaponization of data for particular propaganda purposes. And that's a very, very, very important component of the story of how so many kind of well-meaning people are misled into supporting policies that are really fraudulent and abusive and horrific and grotesque even. But I just want to say that up front, the relationship between actual data and any kind of empirical evidence and the modern punishment bureaucracy in the United States is almost zero. There is no evidence whatsoever that significant increases in the bureaucracies of state violence has anything to do with meaningful levels of interpersonal harm in our society. So every single news article that purports to create some kind of justification or even that juxtaposes these two things together. So like it might talk about drug laws and levels of violence or bail reform and levels of violence or prosecutorial charging policies or the length of sentences and mandatory minimums. All of that stuff is just not connected to the levels at which people are harming each other in our society. They just have really nothing to do with each other. And in fact, the more punishment in a society, the more crime you have long term, because of the cycles of trauma and deprivation that it creates, and because of the levels of inequality that it entrenches. So actually, if you look on a more of a longer term time horizon, the increase of state repression that helps preserve and police and manage levels of inequality in a society are actually the thing that's locking us into higher and higher levels of trauma and victimization and violence. So it's exactly the opposite of the evidence. So when the mayor of Portland is claiming that the solution to violence in our society is more investments in these systems, it's like somebody denying the sort of overwhelming consensus on climate science. And we need to start stigmatizing it like that, because it's absolutely devastating, and it's actually helping us preserve a society that is, has far more pain and trauma and suffering and violence than it need.
And some of the argument tends to get made in ways that are presented to people who are well-meaning and want to be helpful, as though the police are there for the people who are most traumatized and vulnerable. The mayor of Portland is leaning hard on the idea that we need to stop human trafficking and other crimes. As far as I can tell, human trafficking in Portland mainly refers not to actual trafficking and certainly not to labor trafficking, but mainly to misdemeanor solicitation charges, even though Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have argued that sex work needs to be decriminalized. There's a lot of sort of presentation of the benefits of policing for vulnerable communities. It's an equity issue to make sure that people in neighborhoods with high street crime are protected. And that's also something that you talk about, the ways that that gets presented in mass media.
One of the interesting components of propaganda, which I also talk about in the book, is the way in which propagandists prey upon the insecurities of well-meaning people to sort of police the discourse, in the sense that anybody who is proposing reducing the size and power of the punishment bureaucracy and its repressive tentacles is portrayed as somehow not caring about suffering. It's the way that the most brutal and ineffective policies of our society are pitched now more and more by Democratic Party leaders as sort of care, or, you know, policies directed at ending suffering. You'll see this a lot. You know, California just passed a massive boondoggle of violence called the CARE Court Act, you know, which gives the state much more power to intervene in the lives of poor people and unhoused people and people with mental illness. And there's this idea from the mayors of Portland to the mayors of San Jose to the mayor of Los Angeles that we have to be locking up unhoused people for their own good. And we have to be forcing treatment on people for their own good and at gunpoint and with metal chains and cages, etc., inflicting more and more trauma all the while. These are not only disproven scientifically, but you have to understand the propagandistic function here. For many of the populations that are being propagandized, particularly in, you know, populations that think of themselves as more liberal or progressive, these are the same right-wing, police union-backed, corporate-backed policies of state violence that used to be called something else that are now being pitched back to us under a new form of marketing, either as care or as alleviating of suffering or as, you know, like it's in the same way that the global counterinsurgency techniques developed by the British and French militaries in Algeria and Vietnam and the Middle East, and then perfected and employed by the US military in Iraq and Afghanistan, those counterinsurgency tactics came back to the United States under the name community policing. So these are the same things in other countries, in other, let's say, more overtly authoritarian countries like United Arab Emirates or Israel or India or something like that. These same kinds of policies and surveillance technologies and approaches are actually, you know, sold and marketed for what they are. But in the United States, they're sold to liberals as under the guise of things like reform and care and things like that. We've seen a lot of that in Portland, and that's in particular what my research and analysis of the last decade of propaganda surrounding the police body camera shows. All of this is an attempt to give punishment bureaucrats a way, and their allies in the media, obviously, a way of saying, look, if you don't support this increase in the power and surveillance capabilities of the policing industrial complex in the United States, you don't care about violence. And in particular, you don't care about the most marginalized people in our society. And also, by the way, these investments are more important than ever to deal with even the harms caused by that bureaucracy itself. So every instance of police violence becomes an excuse to spend more money on policing. It's kind of like the incredible research of the Duke University economist Bokhar Ba, who's shown that in the wake of police violence, high-profile police violence against Black people in the United States, the stocks of police industry companies go up. You might think, you know, and I think the standard liberal story is that, well, you know, if the policing industrial complex is committing violence, you know, its stocks might go down when the public gets really outraged about violence. But no, the industry understands something that a lot of liberal people and casual news consumers don't understand, which is how good the policing industry is at using its own violence as an excuse for more money, for more training, more technology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so something like the body camera, for example, it was originally something that the multi-billion dollar police surveillance industry was desperate for. The police themselves loved the idea. They wanted mobile surveillance cameras that they controlled in terms of outward-looking video that they could turn on and off whenever they wanted. They could edit. They could sort of impact the virality of how these stories spread or didn't spread throughout the public by controlling it. And most importantly, prosecutors really wanted them too. Everyone understood that they would almost never be used against police, but they would be used to increase the leverage to coerce quick guilty pleas for low-level offenses that sped up the bureaucracy of the mass incarceration, plea bargaining dockets in local courts. So things like trespassing and drug possession and things like that, much easier to prove more quickly and to coerce people into accepting guilty pleas. So all these people really wanted them, and they wanted them so badly that, like, prior to public funding in any meaningful way, they were getting people like Steven Spielberg to donate to private police foundations to get the cops these gadgets they wanted. And then big companies like Amazon and Microsoft and others really saw huge potential here, because this meant ongoing billions of dollars in contracts for IT training, web service hosting, and data storage. And then the big thing, right, was the use of all of this data with artificial intelligence algorithms, facial recognition, voice recognition. They all wanted the sort of dream of the US Army, and from the Army Field Manual. You know, you go to an event or a protest in a native country, and you can substitute, obviously, in the US context, you know, poor neighborhoods or anti-war protests or whatever it is. You have your body camera on, you scan the crowd. Now you can use facial recognition software to see who knows each other, who's there with who, who's out in the streets that day. You create a wealth of information. The police loved this stuff. And it wasn't until after the death of Michael Brown at the hands of the police in Ferguson that they got what they wanted, which was a chance to totally remarket this away from a surveillance tool that the police wanted toward a tool of quote unquote accountability and transparency. Obama proposed hundreds of millions of dollars for police body cameras. State government after state government and local government after local government followed suit. And pretty soon we had billions of dollars now for the greatest boon to police surveillance industry in modern history, all under the guise of quote unquote accountability and transparency, even in a situation where the federal government itself, the DOJ itself, the federal government, in its meta study of body cameras, has found that they do not make police less violent or more accountable. So you have this this entire situation is directly contrary to the evidence. And yet in virtually every news article that I read over a 10-year period, it was portrayed as like a good faith effort at accountability and transparency.
And now they need to keep the budget up because they have to pay for the cameras.
It's not only the cameras. The cameras themselves are relatively cheap. It's the ongoing service and training and IT storage and maintenance and algorithmic licensing and stuff like that that then connects them to all these other databases the police use. And then you need to have people in the prosecutor's office. You basically have this entire bureaucracy that's created around the idea that we have to maintain and store and analyze all these videos.
Which also brings in more people and companies who are invested in continuing this funding because they're benefiting from it financially.
Absolutely. And that's the thing that most people don't fully appreciate about what's called law enforcement. I don't use that term in either of my books, right? I think it's a term of propaganda. It's designed to make us think that there's, you know, some kind of objective situation going on here where like a law is broken and it is enforced, when in fact, these systems only enforce some laws against some people some of the time in some places for some reasons. And what a lot of people don't understand is that the content of our policies are much more correlated with profit and power than they are with any conception on any reasonable metric of safety.
Your book documents all of this at great length. I think about a quarter of the book is footnotes for examples that you discuss. But you also talk about some of the ways of pushing back against this. Tell us about things we can do to resist this, how to respond, and where you're seeing places where you're seeing effective resistance and change in response to the punishment bureaucracy.
Well, let me just say, before you make listeners think that the book is boring and all these footnotes, let me just say that my grandmother has declared that this is one of the most exciting books she's ever read by one of her grandchildren. And also the book tries to be funny throughout. Like I think it's important, even as we're discussing really important, really bleak stuff, you know, sort of how liberals and progressives and well-meaning people generally are made to support right-wing authoritarian stuff. It's really important to be fun and funny and joyful too. So, you know, I think the book is, at least it's intended to be a fun read. And also, if you want, you can also choose to go through the footnotes into my propaganda archive, where you can see the actual news stories that I'm pulling apart in the text. You can see little commentary, additional commentary that I have, maybe a few little jokes snuck in there about particular journalists and others. But, you know, the idea of the book is to be really accessible and fun, even though I do try to show my work, because it's important, I think, to do that. But I think
I did not mean to suggest that it's not an enjoyable read. Painful as much of the information is, and well documented as it is funny. And there are some wonderful moments, the Oscars for best propaganda presentation and things like that.
So. Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say, because sometimes there's a danger of, you know, I think people not picking up the book because they think it's going to be this sort of like really angry screed with nothing fun in it or something like that. I also want to note, before I get to your really good question about what do we do, which is the whole last chapter of the book, you know, on resisting propaganda. I just want to say, part of this, and one of the main things I say in the end of the book, in terms of how we resist, is that we can't resist alone. We have to find community with other people. And I give a lot of suggestions of ways that people from all different walks of life, whether you're a directly impacted person or someone whose family member is directly impacted by the system, or you're a teacher or a nurse or a doctor or a coder or a person who's retired, who has all this time on their hands, like what are the different ways that different people can get involved? Journalists, public defenders, et cetera. There's so many different ways we can all get involved, but almost all of them center around not trying to do this alone, and how to fortify our own minds and to help our communities develop better critical reading and comprehension skills around this stuff. We have to think about how we do it together. So the thing I wanted to say is that in that spirit, you know, I don't get any money from the book. All of the royalties are donated to the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, which I think is one of the finest community-based organizations in the country. It works with unhoused people in the Skid Row neighborhood of Los Angeles to protect each other from police violence, but also to sort of function as a community-based scholarship and organizing hub. And so they published some of the most incredible hands-on direct experience, but really academic research about topics that are so important for places like Portland. You know, the role of police in managing inequality and gentrification, the role of consulting firms and technology companies and healthcare companies and housing developers in particular in managing urban inequality. So anyway, if you buy a copy of the book, all the royalties will go to this amazing organization. And we also, in the spirit of resisting propaganda, we have a fund that provides free books for anybody in prison in the country, and also any teacher who wants to teach the aspects of the book to their students at any level. You can get a free copy of the book for your students. And so if you know anyone who fits into those categories, part of the resistance to propaganda and what we can do about it. And I give lots of templates. I give questions you can ask, questions journalists can ask, questions people can demand journalists ask, questions people can ask of their own officials, readings people can do, little tips for how to organize different groups, court watching and other things like that. There's so many things that we can do, but also we can just become more critical consumers of local news. And I give some advice for how to intervene in your local news gathering process, how to develop relationships with local journalists so you can create pipelines for very different kinds of public safety stories. You might imagine instead of, you know, 7 local news stories about shoplifting the night before, what if you had stories on, you know, all of the landlords in your community that are not installing smoke detectors, and all of the playgrounds in your local jurisdiction where the soil is testing positive for lead, where your children might play, or all of the OSHA inspectors, or the people that test the rivers and for water pollution, and et cetera, et cetera. There's all these things that we're actually implementing in a lot of different jurisdictions where we're literally changing local news away from low-level crimes of the poor toward things that actually people care about more, that address the issues that they care about in their daily lives more. And it's profound how much ordinary people can even change the way their local news covers things, even without getting into some of the big, deep problems with the political economy of how our news industry is owned and operated. Like, there are so many things that we can still do even within that, while also building and organizing around what I think of as a kind of critical political education that we can all do together as we read the news and learn from each other.
Thank you so much, Alec Karakatsanis, for talking with us about your really great book, Propaganda, How Police and the Media Manipulate Our News. Alec Karakatsanis will be appearing at Powell City of Books on Burnside and 10th on Sunday, May 18th at 7 p.m. Thank you so much for talking with us on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks for having me. I'll see everybody at Powell's.
That was Fran Michel speaking with the author of Propaganda, Alec Karakatsanis. Once again, he will be speaking at Powell's Books on Burnside this coming Sunday, May 18 at 7 p.m. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland.
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, we got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See the halibuts and the sturgeons being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly. But they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink. But stay away from the kitchen sink. Throw out your breakfast garbage. And I've got a hunch that the folks downstream will drink it for lunch. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They're drinking the water and breathing the air.
That was a bit of Tom Lehrer with his classic song, Pollution. The song was released in 1965. That was 5 years before the passage of the landmark Clean Air Act. That act was designed to regulate the emissions of toxins into our air in order to protect the public health. But 55 years later, and according to the 2025 annual report of the American Lung Association, nearly half of U.S. residents breathe unhealthy air. Now, here in Portland, we definitely have an air quality problem. Back in 2012, the Portland Air Toxics Study looked at cancer-causing pollutants that are not routinely monitored and found that of the 19 that they looked at, 14 of them were above the levels that adversely affect human health. Then our listeners might remember there was the notorious U.S. Forest Service Moss study in 2013, which revealed alarmingly high levels of cadmium and arsenic in the air that turned out to be from glass factories. Just last year, as part of its initiative to reduce urban pollution, the Environmental Protection Agency fingered North Northwest Portland as one of 27 communities nationwide that are most overburdened, that's their word, overburdened with toxic air pollution. Now, that's not a great distinction to have. Now, despite Zena's significant contribution to air pollution in North Portland, and despite the whole host of problems with Zenith that I'm sure our listeners are aware of, what I fear we will hear from DEQ in the end is that they have no grounds to deny the air quality permit. They'll tell us that their hands are tied. So we have all this pollution. We have this installation that's emitting all these toxics. Well, what gives? If you take a close look at EPA and DEQ and how they monitor and control air pollution, what you find is that the system is pretty much rigged in favor of polluting corporate entities. I'm a board member of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I've been looking at and speaking about air quality issues in Portland for the past several years. Today, I asked Jan Hocken to come onto the air to talk with me about air quality here in Portland. Jan is a local filmmaker and director of Necessity, Climate Justice, and the Thin Green Line. That feature-length documentary followed local activists as they enlisted the necessity defense in a jury trial after being arrested for a direct action at Zenith Energy in Portland. The trial resulted in a hung jury and the charges were dropped. So, Jan, thank you for coming on the air. I just made a pretty bold accusation about air quality standards and enforcement. There's lots to talk about. Where do you think we should start?
I think before turning to the EPA and how to think about the EPA and its job, I think it would be helpful to set the dramaturgy that I think most of us are familiar with. The central dramaturgy in the film was the struggle with the city that had said, our hands are tied around, you know, the way that Zenith got its initial permits, and the permitting process has been the central struggle. The EPA has been kind of in the background of this stage as kind of a Greek chorus trying to warn and do its job, but burdened by its own limited mandate. Just in March, late March, the Portland City Council adopted the Zenith Accountability Resolution, demanding investigations into the city's conduct and the Zenith franchise agreement. Damon Matsudori with Oregon Sierra Club said Portland just showed that we have the power to defend our communities from dangerous, dirty fuels. The corrupt Trump administration is gutting the EPA to give handouts to fossil fuel companies and so on. Before turning to the EPA, how would you arrange the key protagonists on the stage here in the fight of communities, particularly student communities that are most affected by these toxins against these corporations and their political allies?
Well, I'll say a couple things about that. The first thing I think that's most important is that many of the significant progress that has been made locally in terms of bringing corporate entities to heel and installing the proper pollution controls or shutting down or whatever have all been through citizen action pressuring the DEQ. It's the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. They generally require some prodding.
DEQ also, just to clarify the point you're making, even the pressure on city council around transparency or permitting and some positive gestures from the city council this year, the DEQ weighs in on that.
Well, DEQ is the entity that's responsible for either allowing an air quality permit or disallowing. They have the authority. And to bring the EPA back in, it's the EPA is generally speaking, is the agency at the national level that sets the standards. And DEQ primarily is in the business of enforcing those standards. And I think a lot of activists look at Zenith and say, bad actor, putting out pollutants, a big earthquake risk. To us, it's obvious. And I think what people often don't quite understand is that the regulatory apparatus is so narrowly conceived and so much designed to favor corporate interests that it's really difficult to get an agency like DEQ, even if it wants to shut down an entity like Zenith. And if they tried, Zenith would take them to court and would likely win because, these are very narrowly conceived regulations. That, well, that's mainly what I wanted to talk about this
Can you
morning.
establish one other element of the dramaturgy, and that is
Sure.
Zenith. So Zenith is only one corporation in this hub. Why are we focusing so much on Zenith?
Originally, I think we focused on Zenith because a lot of people felt that it was in violation of the spirit, if not the actual law, the law that was passed that Portland would not permit any new fossil fuel infrastructure. And they managed to slide under the door with an already established air quality permit. And we were in a legal battle, and I think we would have won that legal battle until the Portland City Council capitulated, basically. The city capitulated through a backdoor deal. I think that's why there's a lot of outrage around Zenith. And there's more. They've been a very bad corporate actor.
So let's return to and you made a distinction, of course, between the EPA at the federal level and the DEQ, the state level that carries out both Oregon's own mandates, as well as some federal guidelines.
Yeah, it determines some of its own standards, but the air quality standards in general are set by EPA. So I want to talk first about the so-called safe levels. Let me talk about benzene because benzene is a volatile organic compound. It's very toxic at very low levels, a very potent carcinogen, and it's something that Zenith belches out on a daily basis as part of its normal operations. The safe level that Oregon endorses is that if you breathe over a long period of time, like over your lifetime, if you breathe air that has any more than a third of a grain of salt in a boxcar, that's how much benzene we're talking about, a third of a grain of salt in an empty boxcar. If you breathe in that level of benzene over a lifetime, you start to see problems with your immune system. You start to see blood cancers. So you can see how very, very toxic benzene is. Now, how do we know that about benzene? We know that because of occupational studies and because of animal studies. There are very, very few big community studies that look at a community that's exposed to benzene over a long period of time to say what the effects are. There was actually such a study done in 2024 in England, and it found that for every little rise in benzene in the air, the mortality from all causes in those populations went up. So we know benzene is a bad actor. But the fact that these are extrapolated safe levels, what that means is that different methods are used by different agencies like the World Health Organization, the EU, Canada's EPA equivalent. So there are different standards. There isn't even a general agreement. The World Health Organization says on its website that benzene is unsafe at any level. But the real big problem with these standards is that the assumption is that you're being exposed to one chemical at a time. That just never happens in an urban area or anywhere. You don't get exposed just to one toxin. And so there are additive effects, there are multiplicative effects. None of that is taken into account. But as it turns out, it probably doesn't even matter too much that we know what a safe level of benzene is, because those safe levels that have been established for thousands of toxins, EPA has done that work. So I want to defend EPA a little bit here. But those standards that they've established really don't inform the other set of standards that they developed, which are the emission standards. And this tells industrial applications, industrial settings, how much benzene or particulate matter or arsenic or whatever they can emit into the air. That's a whole nother process. They're not based on some determination about if you let an industry emit this much, then you'll get this level in the air. That's not the process. The standard is developed based on an application of what they call the best technology available and the throughput for a particular industry. So using Zenith again as an example, Zenith says, well, we're going to process 100 gallons of crude oil per hour. And the DEQ then uses this best technology available to cut down on emissions and says, okay, if you're putting that much crude oil through your operation and you use the best technology available to cut down on emissions, then this is what your VOC, for example, emissions or your benzene emissions will be. That has nothing to do with what benzene actually ends up in the air in the sense of whether it's safe or not.
I know the statements that Zenith has made for quite some time now is they understand that fossil fuels carry all these toxic properties, and we need to move toward renewables, and that they are in fact moving toward renewables with biodiesel. You know, how do their claims register in the same process and the limited tools that are available to the EPA?
Well, in terms of their toxic emissions, we're still talking about highly volatile fuels that they're handling. And that does, the fact that they're going to be handling so-called renewable diesel doesn't really make that much difference. What matters is the fact that they're expanding operations, and the more they expand, the more they are legally permitted to emit. That's one of the big problems with this way of monitoring or of regulating emissions. The next time they come around, they want to expand, then they'll be permitted to emit even more benzene or volatile organic compounds.
So
And
whatever arguments and solutions Zenith offers are basically false solutions and
well, I
shut
think you're
that off.
confounding a couple of different issues, one of which is renewable diesel, which is really not renewable. And there are all sorts of problems with renewable diesel, and we don't want it coming through
Right.
Portland. I think the other issue is the contribution that they make on a daily basis to air pollution in Portland. And the problem with this way of regulating it, which is, you tell us how much throughput you're going to have, how much volume you're going to have, and we'll tell you how much, what your cap is on your VOCs based on the best technology available. What that means is that there are a couple things you will never, ever hear DEQ say. One is, no, Zenith, you can't expand your operations because we already have too many VOCs in Portland in the air. You'll never hear them say that. You'll never hear them say to a new company coming in, no, I'm sorry, we already have too much VOC contamination in the air.
Why is the DEQ so impotent as an actor on this stage?
Because that's the way the regulations are designed. They're designed not to look at air quality in a community and then regulate who operates there based on what the air quality is. What they're designed to do is to look at each individual industry and regulate those emissions separately. So if you have one installation in an area, maybe not so bad, but at the CEI hub and in Northwest Portland, you have a ton of installations. Half of the polluting industries in Portland are located in North Northwest Portland. So you have this huge concentration of pollutants being emitted into the air. But all DEQ can do is make sure that based on the volume of stuff they're handling at the CEI hub, the installations there, that they utilize best technology and tamp down on what they're emitting. That's the best DEQ can do. That's the way the system is set up.
So one arm of the DEQ is to measure and monitor, and then the other arm is how they enforce regulations. What would you say about that?
Well, that's very problematic as well. I think it's important to understand that there may be thousands of chemicals that are being emitted, and the vast majority of them are not monitored or measured at all. When emissions are monitored, like volatile organic compounds, for the most part, depending on the industry, it's a little complicated, but for the most part, these are not, there isn't some measurement that's taken at the stack. Instead, they use these formulas to calculate based again on their throughput. So we're going to run 100 gallons through, and based on that, we apply all these formulas, and this is how much VOC we think we're emitting. And the problem is that the formula that's most commonly used has been found to routinely underestimate what those VOCs are that are being emitted. So those calculations, you really can't depend on them. Now, they are backed up sometimes by spot measurements where they actually measure, but this is a process that DEQ has very little oversight over. It's the responsibility of the entity like Zenith to call in a proprietary outfit, at a date and time of their choosing and make this measurement. And and without much DEQ oversight. And, who knows how accurate that is. And let me just mention one more thing that I think people may not understand is that there is almost no monitoring in the community of these various toxins to let us know that, oh my gosh, too much stuff is coming out of the CEI hub. The closest monitor to the CEI hub that looks for toxins in the air is at 57th and Southeast Lafayette, Southeast Portland. And it monitors for VOCs and particulates and various things. There are no community monitors in Linton. There's no community monitors in Overlook. There's a
Isn't there a call for, I suppose you call them citizen scientists, community groups to monitor because the overseeing bureaucracy is so captured by the industry or so narrowly obsessive in its approach?
Well, Portland Clean Air is actually very sophisticated about this, and they've been working on community air quality monitoring for a number of years. And they are in the process of purchasing some very accurate mobile VOC monitors that they can put on a scooter
And
and
VOC means
ride volatile organic compound like benzene. So this is a monitor that'll look at benzene levels. They can mount it on a scooter. They can drive it all over North Portland and then can actually create maps of levels of benzene based on time and weather and location and potentially figure out where most the VOCs are coming from or where the benzene is coming from. So that's a very exciting project, and there's lots of room for people in North Portland to be involved in that project. And that's actually the kind of thing that is going to produce the most results in terms of cleaning up the air in Portland. Everyone should come out if they can to the University of Portland tonight for the hearing. It's really important to show that the community does not want Zenith in Portland. And even if DEQ ends up approving that permit, that's not the end of the story. It's very important for us to be educating each other about the limitations that they face. I'll tell you, there are a lot of really good people at DEQ who would like to do a lot better job. And the more we're out there calling for better monitoring in the community and not relying on these formulas to determine, what the emissions are and allowing the industries to underreport. The more we educate ourselves, the more we demonstrate that the community is really knowledgeable and persistent and is going to continue to oppose Zenith and other corporate bad actors.
Part of it, what you're saying is it's important to really look closely at these agencies that are supposed to make these industries safe, the regulatory apparatus, and how weak it is, and to separate false solutions from genuine alternatives
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
the necessity film is available to distribute it online if people are interested in some of that history. It follows some of the history of Zenith in the region. So it's called Necessity: Climate Justice and the Thin Green Line. But as you're reminding us, the struggle continues, and
Right.
it's no decisive denouement, but it's important to be educated so we're not fooled by these false solutions.
DEQ is holding an in-person public hearing for people to comment on Zenith. That's tonight, May 12th. It's at the Buckley Center Auditorium at the University of Portland. That's 5000 North Willamette Boulevard. There's a rally at 6 p.m. The hearing will start at 6:30. You can also join via Zoom, And there's also going to be a virtual hearing via Zoom on May 15th from 6 to 8:30 p.m., which is another opportunity to testify and weigh in. The deadline for submission of written comments is 5 p.m., May 30th, and those can also be submitted online or through email. All that information is on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. That does it for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Fran Michelle, and Jan Hocken for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guest, Alec Karakatsanis. As always, a shout out to the hardworking staff at KBOO who make this show possible. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Join us again next Monday morning for more views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm going to leave you today with one of my favorite environmental songs, Mercy, Mercy Me by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening.
Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are lies. Mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand it?